Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present investigative journalist Robert Perry, who discusses the ongoing conflict in eastern Ukraine and the U.S. news media's failure to honestly report on the roots of the crisis and the role of neo-Nazi militia groups. Reverend Lee Dreyer, pastor of the White Oak Spring Presbyterian Church in Butler County, Pennsylvania, who talks about how his community has offered clean water to families affected by natural gas fracking pollution. And Jonah Minkoff-Zern of Public Citizens Democracy is for People campaign, who talks about a recent Senate vote permitting debate on the proposed Democracy for All constitutional amendment that would overturn the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United ruling. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In late August, General Javier Flores, deputy commander of Colombia's army, sat down for the first face-to-face negotiations with representatives of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. It marked a new and difficult stage in the Havana peace talks to end the 50-year civil war in Colombia. Thus far, the FARC and the Colombian government have reached agreements on land reform, future political participation for the rebels, and an accord on drug trafficking. Now, the peace talks will focus on compensation for war victims and demobilization of thousands of FARC fighters. Meanwhile, pressure is building inside Colombia for FARC commanders to serve jail time for abuses committed during the civil war, similar to comparable sentences handed out to right-wing paramilitary soldiers who agreed to disclose information on thousands of deaths and disappearances. Concluding a ceasefire agreement and disarming the leftist rebel group are among the thorniest topics remaining in the talks, the fourth and most promising attempt so far to end the decades-long conflict. Colombia's civil war has killed 220,000 people and caused more than 5 million others to flee their homes since the 1960s. For the first time, the top U.S. immigration court, the Board of Immigration Appeals, ruled that migrants who were the victims of domestic abuse in their home countries can apply for asylum in the U.S. The case involved a Guatemalan woman, Aminta Cifuentes, who migrated to the United States after years of domestic abuse that included beatings and rape at the hands of her husband. The immigration court concluded Guatemalan authorities had refused to intervene in this specific case of domestic violence. According to Mother Jones magazine, U.S. immigration courts had previously rejected domestic violence claims. In this case, the Board of Immigration Appeals ruled married women in Guatemala who are unable to leave their relationships were a unique social group and were entitled to protection under U.S. asylum law. Fox News hosts and commentators blasted the immigration ruling. Steve Camarada of the right-wing Center for Immigration Studies fumed that the domestic violence ruling would prompt tens of millions of women migrants to enter the U.S. illegally. However, California lawyer Simona Agnolucci, who is active in asylum cases, called the right-wing fear of opening the floodgates absurd, since immigration courts have long provided opportunities for refugees who have a well-founded fear of persecution to have their cases heard in court. Deep underneath the New Mexico desert, a 55-gallon drum of nuclear waste buried in a salt shaft broke apart in February, releasing a white foam laced with plutonium that went airborne and up a ventilation duct, contaminating 21 workers with low-level radiation. The accident contaminated the United States' only underground dump for nuclear weapons waste. Yet the cause of the leak still remains a mystery after a six-month investigation. The Los Angeles Times reports that the U.S. Department of Energy has been unable to identify the exact chemical ingredients inside the punctured drum. The incident at the waste isolation pilot plant near Carlsbad, New Mexico, will likely cause that facility to remain shut down for 18 months. As a result, radioactive shipments from nuclear waste sites across the country are now backlogged. A preliminary U.S. Energy Department investigation uncovered more than 30 safety violations at the Carlsbad facility. The report also cited hazardous situations like a salt hauling truck, which caught fire and burned for hours only days before the leakage of nuclear waste was discovered. News reports estimate that the cleanup costs at the storage site could exceed $1 billion. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
An offensive by Ukraine's military targeting the remaining enclaves of pro-Russian separatists seemed poised for victory in recent weeks, but those gains were soon reversed as the eastern Ukraine rebels regrouped and took back territory from government troops. The Kiev government and NATO accused Russia of sending arms and soldiers across the border that helped the rebels turn the tide, ignoring American and European Union threats of additional economic sanctions. On September 5th, not long after the separatists launched their counteroffensive, Ukraine's government signed a ceasefire agreement with pro-Russian rebels in the Belarus capital of Minsk. The 12-point ceasefire plan called for an exchange of prisoners and special autonomous status for the Russian-speaking regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. The ceasefire remains fragile, with reports of violations on both sides, despite continuing dialogue between Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Throughout the recent NATO summit meeting in Wales, officials warned of the threat of an expansionist Russia, citing Vladimir Putin's March annexation of Crimea and the continuing conflict in eastern Ukraine. In an echo of the Cold War, NATO announced during the summit the creation of a new rapid response military force based in eastern Europe, designed to quickly counter any future Russian incursion into the region. Your reporter spoke with investigative journalist Robert Perry, editor of ConsortiumNews.com. Here, Perry discusses the ongoing conflict in eastern Ukraine and the U.S. corporate news media's failure to honestly report on the roots of the crisis and the role of Kiev government-allied neo-Nazi militia groups.
Well, the silliest fallacy of all of the Ukraine crisis is the idea that Putin instigated it. He didn't. He was trying to maintain the status quo in Ukraine, i.e. Ukraine that was relatively neutral, tended to do business more with Russia than Europe. There's no evidence, and there's no intelligence that he ever had any intentions of seizing territory and rebuilding the Soviet empire or the Russian empire or whatever you want to call it. He was busy with the Sochi Olympics back in February of this year. When much of this played out, this was not something that he initiated. It was initiated by the West, first with the EU, which offered this association agreement with Ukraine, which President Yanukovych considered and was actually inclined to probably move toward. But then when the International Monetary Fund came in and said that as part of this deal, you're going to have to accept all these very harsh, quote-unquote, reforms, which would have made life for Ukrainians even harder than it already is, Yanukovych turned back to Moscow and accepted a $15 billion loan deal that didn't have all these strings attached. And that's what set off the crisis. It wasn't something that Putin provoked. In fact, we know based on writings from some leading neoconservatives, including Carl Gershman, president of the National Endowment for Democracy, as early as last September, a year ago, he went to the Washington Post and said getting control of Ukraine was, quote, the biggest prize. And he said that beyond that would be the idea of isolating and ultimately getting rid of Putin. So Putin was really the target of this, not the instigator.
Robert, I wanted to turn our attention to U.S. Corporate media's coverage of the Ukraine crisis. And you bring up the fact that there are well-known neo-Nazi elements in the newly established Kiev government. And as the conflict arose, there are these neo-Nazi militia groups that have been accused of abuses in the field. From your reporting, you find that the United States media goes out of its way to either reduce the importance of these neo-Nazi organizations within the Kiev government or omit the information altogether. I wondered if you'd talk about the process you think that is going on in these newsrooms and in the reporters' minds when they go out of their way to distort reality, which is certainly a disservice to their audience.
Well, from the beginning of this situation, really last fall, when Yanukovych turned away from the association agreement with the EU and the Maidan demonstrations became quite powerful, sort of a popular uprising almost in western Ukraine, the U.S. news media embraced the uprising. They treated it like these were totally wonderful people that were entirely justified in seeking to overthrow the elected government of Yanukovych. They treated Yanukovych like someone who was a dictator, even though he'd been elected. So the press tended to ignore the fact that as the Maidan demonstrations proceeded, they increasingly drew their muscle from these neo-Nazi groups, which operated in mostly western Ukraine, based in Lviv, involving Svoboda, which was a right-wing neo-Nazi party that was even condemned by the European Parliament just in 2012, about a year before this crisis began. So essentially, the New York Times, Washington Post, and all the major news organizations, CBS News, treated this as a white hat, black hat story, where there were these wonderful demonstrators, totally idealistic and great, and these nasty people who were ethnic Russians who may have had sympathies for Moscow. So it became that kind of a reporting assignment, and once that sort of gets rolling, it becomes increasingly difficult for journalists to stand against it. One of the problems also, though, was this neo-Nazi element. So what the U.S. media did was essentially ignore it. Or when it would be mentioned by people, it would be called Russian propaganda. But it wasn't. It was real. And what we've seen now, and occasionally you'll see this in the mainstream press itself, because some reporters might put a reference, in the case of the New York Times, on August 10th, they had a story. It was a long story about something else, but in the last three paragraphs, they mentioned that one of the Avov battalion, which was one of the militias fighting in the east, was carrying this banner used by the Hitler's SS. These were openly Nazi militia people who were doing the worst, hardest fighting in eastern Ukraine. You also had an Amnesty International report about a different one of the militia groups sent out by the Kiev government talking about its war crimes. So you have here a rather remarkable story, and the U.S. media keeps telling the readership, basically, either by ignoring it or by downplaying it, that it's not really a story. And I think that's an extraordinary moment for the American press.
That was investigative journalist Robert Perry, editor of ConsortiumNews.com, one of the reporters who helped expose the Iran-Contra scandal in the mid-1980s. Find links to Perry's recent articles on Ukraine and related material by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the Marcellus Shale gas fracking boom in western Pennsylvania continues, more and more residents are finding their formerly pure well water contaminated. Most of the contamination has not been proven to be caused by the gas industry, but residents say their problems started when the gas infrastructure came in. Wells, processing facilities, and compressor stations, along with a huge increase in heavy truck traffic. One group of affected residents lives in a low-income neighborhood of about 200 homes called the Woodlands in Butler County, surrounded by 65 wells within a 2-mile radius. John Stoltz, a researcher from Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, interviewed 3/4 of these residents and found 40% reported problems with their water. Testing revealed the presence of high amounts of certain chemicals, but none that are among the most toxic. Gas drilling company Rex Energy and the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection determined that residents' well water didn't differ significantly from pre-drill samples taken by the company, although Stoltz notes that the wells were not tested when fracking was occurring. Further, the DEP did not test for all chemicals related to the fracking process, and the company has not revealed its pre-drill testing results. 9 families from the Woodlands filed lawsuits against Rex Energy last year, claiming the company's practices contributed to the decline of their water quality, health, and quality of life. The residents were left to deal with the problem on their own until several area churches got together to set up a clean water bank. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus just completed a reporting trip to the area where she spoke with many affected residents and Reverend Lee Dreyer, pastor of the White Oak Spring Presbyterian Church in Butler County, which houses the water bank. Here he describes how the water bank works, whom it serves, and what kind of resolution the affected families are seeking.
Every Monday, we alternate between mornings and evenings for those people who work. We open our back door here for people to come and pick up crates or cartons of gallon jugs of water, depending on the size of the family, depends on how much they get, but it's usually 20 to 40 gallons per family per week. We usually get around 300 gallons per week, and we distribute, depending on the week, around 300 to 400 gallons of water.
How many families participate?
Right now, and I'm just going to give you a ballpark figure, approximately 35 families. We started off with 11 about 2.5 years ago, and since that time there have been more and more and more families whose water has been affected by the fracking. So we're going on 3.5, 4 years that these people have to deal with tainted, polluted, smelly, discolored water coming out of their spigots and shower heads.
I mean, it starts to get really expensive to have to buy water. They're getting it donated, but whoever's buying it, you know, the people who are volunteering, you know, giving money to do it, it's ongoing. It starts to get expensive.
Yeah, it's about $1 a gallon, and we have been blessed with some really good folks, as I said, individuals and some churches in the area, mostly Presbyterian, have been really, really gracious. And since we started, we have not run out of money. We've gotten low, but then God is good, and we get some influx of cash that has helped us out. And so we've never had a week that we weren't able to distribute the water.
What do you see down the road? I mean, just more and more families needing the water and ongoing donations to help them out. Do you see or do you know of efforts to try to change the game in a way that people would be able to get their water functioning again in a way that they could drink it?
Well, the goal was that we would be done with this by this time. We were hoping that they could have water piped into their area by the local governments, both county and the township governments, but they have not been very responsive. I think they would wish that the people in the Woodlands would just go away and they didn't have to worry about this. These are tax-paying citizens. They work, they pay their taxes, but been completely ignored by the powers that be. And so we were hoping we'd be done, but there seems to be no end in sight. We hear rumors that there's going to be money provided by either the gas companies themselves or by government that they'll be able to get the water pipes laid and then they'd hook up to those water pipes and they would be able to turn on their faucets and get nice clean cold water coming out of there, but so far it hasn't happened. So there is no end in sight. We will keep going as long as we can, as long as we have the money and as long as there's a need.
So you said right in the beginning that this water crisis was caused by fracking, but in fact there's no proof of that. Isn't that correct? Like the companies say that it's not them, and I don't think there's been proof of that they're responsible. Is that right?
You're
smiling.
You're talking to the wrong person. Of course, the gas companies are going to deny it, and those who would support them would deny it. I have my suspicions because of just what I've observed. I've seen water the color of apple cider coming out of people's faucets. I have seen water, in one case, the color of used motor oil coming out of there. And others will say, well, it's not the gas company's fault. I have my strong suspicions. I'm very much concerned about the air quality, what is spewing forth from the drilling sites. It came home very closely within the past few months because there is a new drilling site just about less than a quarter mile from where we live here in the township, where my wife and two kids live. And I am certainly concerned about the quality of the air also. What I've told lots of people is I'm all in favor as far as becoming energy independent and all that and providing jobs for people. I'm all for it, but it has to be safe. Has to be. And thus far, I have not seen the proof that it is absolutely 100% safe.
That was Reverend Lee Dreyer, pastor of the White Oak Spring Presbyterian Church that hosts a water bank for residents in the Woodlands in western Pennsylvania. For more information on groups concerned about health and safety issues related to natural gas fracking, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As momentum has gathered to overturn the controversial Supreme Court rulings in the Citizens United and McCutcheon cases that opened the floodgates of unlimited and unaccountable money in U.S. election campaigns, activists across the country have been working hard to raise the issue at both the state and federal levels. On September 8th, the U.S. Senate voted 79-18 to allow debate and a vote on the proposed Democracy for All constitutional amendment that would overturn much of the campaign finance precedents set forth by the conservative majority in the High Court's recent rulings. The amendment, sponsored by Senator Tom Udall, Democrat of New Mexico, would authorize Congress in the states to regulate and limit fundraising and spending on federal candidates, and would also prevent the Supreme Court from reversing future campaign finance regulations passed by Congress. Although Senate Democrats temporarily overcame a possible Republican filibuster, the amendment will likely be defeated because a two-thirds vote is required in both the Senate and the House, followed by two-thirds of the 50 states ratifying the measure in order to become part of the U.S. Constitution. Senator Udall, lead sponsor of the bill, said before the vote, quote, "We are here to say as strongly and forcefully as we can, corporations are not people. And we're here to take back our democracy from billionaires." Republicans counter by asserting that campaign spending is a form of free speech. Your reporter spoke with Jonah Minkoff-Zern, director of Public Citizens Democracy is for People campaign, the group which turned in 3 million petition signatures supporting the Democracy for All amendment. Here he talks about the significance of the Senate vote in what many believe will be a long, hard battle to victory.
I mean, it's an exciting moment, the Democracy for All amendment. We're going to get a vote in the Senate. We overcame the Republican filibuster with a 79-19 vote. You know, what this means is that our voices, you know, so many of your listeners, I'm sure, and so many people across the country have been working for the last four, almost 5 years in Citizens United, and many of us for long before that, to overturn the idea that money is speech, that government can't regulate election spending, and the idea of corporate personhood, that that corporations have the same rights as individuals. So the Democracy for All amendment, it gets close to addressing both those things. It doesn't go far enough in addressing corporate personhood, but what it says is that government has a right to regulate campaign contributions, whether it's from an individual, whether it's from a corporation, whether it's from any entity, that government can place reasonable limitations on campaign contributions. The second thing it does is it says that government can place different regulations on individuals and corporations, so it can up to completely eliminating the ability of corporations to contribute. So in essence, it addresses corporate personhood in election spending, but as many people want, it doesn't go further to say corporations don't have the same rights as individuals in any area, like, for example, placing a billboard outside an elementary school and saying that's protected speech right. It wouldn't prevent a corporation from saying it has the same rights as individuals in that area. But it's an exciting moment that we have 50 senators who have already expressed their support, 49 of them as sponsors for this vote, and the remaining five Democrats have all committed to voting yes on the amendment. So we're in a place where we have 55 senators in support, which is a long way from a few years ago where we had two or three senators in support of an amendment. And it's because of the massive movement that's taking place.
What is necessary to pass a constitutional amendment here in the U.S.? What is the process, if you could lay it out for us, beyond the Senate vote that I believe they have to attain a two-thirds majority?
That's right. Well, there needs to be a two-thirds majority. There also needs to be three-fourths of the states to ratify it after it passes through both houses of Congress with a two-thirds majority. So we're not going to get that this time, or we don't believe we are. We're pushing hard, and everyone around the country is pushing hard to round up 12 more votes for this time, but we don't believe that's going to happen, and we don't think it's going to hear the light of day in the House this year. But we're working to get to that point. Every generation has had its constitutional amendment, and we see this as our generation's.
As you look at the process, it's a fairly high bar to be successful in getting a constitutional amendment. Are you optimistic that you'll be successful in the coming years, or is this going to take a decade or more, do you think?
I think it's hard to say. We look back in history, and it took 60 years to overturn Plessy v. Ferguson, another heinous Supreme Court ruling that said that separate is equal. And that was through another Supreme Court ruling in Brown v. Board. I don't know how long this is going to take us. I do know that it's going to happen because people across the political spectrum are really passionate about this. And when people are polled at about 70 to 75 to 80%, depending on how and what's asked of them, they support this. They support getting big money out of politics, and they specifically support a constitutional amendment to do so. And it really is across the political spectrum. And, for example, the states of Colorado and Montana voted for a constitutional amendment on their ballot by a really wide margin, by 75% each, in 2012. So I think this is something that's happening. I think more and more people see that there is a price that we pay when our elections are bought, when we don't have a real say in our democracy and our political process. And more people are realizing that this is necessary, and they're willing to do something about it. At the root of our nation, what our founders fought and died for was to create a democracy against a ruling elite. And the idea that our founders in creating the First Amendment would want that to mean that it could be bought and sold, that the ruling elite could control our elections is preposterous. It's just a necessary step right now for us to have that limitation, and it's something across the political spectrum people can see.
That was Jonah Minkoff-Zern, Director of Public Citizens' Democracy is for People campaign. Find more information on groups working to overturn the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.